From Kansas to South Carolina, Missouri to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, NVIDIA is making a $100 billion investment in OpenAI as U.S. competition with China to develop artificial intelligence heats up. Alden Abbott from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with details. The federal government appears headed for an October 1st shutdown as U.S. Senate Democrats refuse to approve a continuing budget resolution. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. While all eyes have been focused on the war between Russia and Ukraine, Poland has undergone a remarkable economic transformation, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College offers his remembrance and discusses the continuing legacy of Charlie Kirk on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The United States is engaged in fierce competition with China to lead the world in the development of artificial intelligence. NVIDIA this past week announced a $100 billion investment toward that goal. Alden Abbott is Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and he is a former General Counsel to the Federal Trade Commission. He is here to discuss. Alden, welcome to American Radio Journal. Alden, when we talk about the term artificial intelligence, it means different things to different people, but explain for us what we mean by that term. What type of technology are we discussing?
AI, or artificial intelligence, basically refers to computer systems that are designed to perform tasks that typically require human intelligence, such as learning, problem solving, decision-making, and understanding language. Now, these systems often use technologies like so-called machine learning to learn from data and identify patterns without explicit programming, which basically machines are enabled to analyze information, make predictions, automate processes, and interact with the world in complex ways, from everything from recognizing speech to driving cars. Now, to be clear, that humans are providing the information or that goes into the so-called AI models. So so-called general language models where AI systems are asked to, you know, say what is important about X or how do you analyze a policy is based on information they've been given that has been basically inserted into the system. So the real concern is that you need to know what sorts of data has been put in. Has it been biased in any way? So in other words, it's the old cliche, garbage in, garbage out. These systems have incredible potential because of sort of faster computing speeds, better chips, and so on. They're able to process the information much more quickly and use it creatively. But at the same time, they rely on what humans have decided to put into the system in the first place.
We are, of course, in a heated competition here, particularly with China. There's been a major development here in terms of investment in the development of AI technology, of computer chips here. NVIDIA investing in OpenAI. What is the nature of their investment? The number, I understand, is pretty eye-popping.
NVIDIA really is a maker of some of the most innovative, fastest, most technologically novel chips, semiconductor chips and systems. They're really a technology leader in the U.S. It's an industry where Intel used to be the leading firm and pioneer, but it's certainly been surpassed by, in terms of innovativeness and corporate value, by NVIDIA. Now, NVIDIA has announced a $100 billion investment in OpenAI, which is a big purveyor of, you know, these AI systems, which I've just described. So that means the $100 billion are going to be used to improve technology used by OpenAI, the amount of data they can obtain, the way in which they can improve it, All of these AI systems, basically, the idea is that they're not static. I mentioned you that they get information, but that information is updated with time, and the way in which they can process it is improved over time. So that's a huge investment. But OpenAI has gotten investments from, albeit smaller, through alliances with Microsoft, Oracle, SoftBank, Stargate, all major tech companies, all focused in their own way in constructing large advanced AI infrastructure to help their companies move along. And so that's the basically what's happened. Other AI companies are also getting investments from tech companies that want to ride this technology to improve their offerings.
So we have all this investment that the private sector is putting in here, Alden. Let's talk for just a minute or so here about government. Is there a way to get government out of the way? That tends to be what happens with overregulation and various hoops that companies have to go through. Are there any efforts in Congress to sort of smooth that pathway?
There's been talk on the Hill of sort of legislation. I haven't spent a lot of time looking at it closely because I think, for one thing, all of this is A, premature, and B, unnecessary right now. Look, this is competition at its fullest. You've got firms, let's say Microsoft, NVIDIA, Oracle, SoftBank, all at different stages and the tech industry providing software, providing chips, providing technological solutions, and there is not one dominant AI company. There are lots of companies and other companies getting investments as well. What does this mean? This is this competition that's vibrant, and it's what you want if you want U.S. tech companies to become leading players internationally. Government regulation or limiting how much companies can invest in NVIDIA or saying that we don't want any, rather in OpenAI, or rather saying no big company like NVIDIA should have a major investment above a certain level or should take equity shares, that just discourages aggressive competition and attempts to better your competitors, and it will make technological innovation slow in the U.S. So there seems to be, it's the same sort of concern that was raised about the big platforms. You know, all the monopolization cases which have been brought against Facebook and Google and Amazon sort of presuppose that some harm is being done to the economy and to consumers. Well, some competitors are losing out or less, but there's no evidence I know that the consumer welfare and the country has not overall benefited from what the companies on the whole are doing. Not to say company can't behave any competitively, but getting back to the question, I think that right now you have no monopoly companies in AI. You have lots of investments from lots of tech companies. And unless and until some tech company, say, tries to buy up a bunch of major AI competitors or prevent them from dealing with other tech companies, I don't see an antitrust problem. And I think government should stand by and let the market charge at full speed ahead.
Alden Abbott is Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center, that, of course, located at George Mason University. Alden, tell us a bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, can you give us a website? You have written extensively on this and related issues. If people would like to learn more, where can they find you?
The Mercatus Center is a university-affiliated research organization dedicated to promoting free markets that looks at specific public policy issues through the lens of free market economic analysis and tries to propose solutions that can improve society. Mercatus can be found at www.mercatus.org. Again, www.mercatus.org.
Alden Abbott, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Alden, thank you for taking time to be with us.
And thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We're going to talk in a minute or so here about the federal budget deadline, which is upon us. But before we do, Scott, let's talk for just a couple of minutes. We have two gubernatorial races in the country this year, Virginia and New Jersey. Both are uphill slogs for Republicans. But what do you see the political climate in those states as being like at this point?
The interesting thing in both these races is that there's no incumbent. In Virginia, our Commonwealth does not allow for the governor to run consecutive terms. You can take 4 years off and run again, but you can only serve one term before you got to hand it over to somebody else to give it a shot. And we've got a nominee, our Lieutenant Governor Winsome Sears, that has been the de facto nominee for a long time. Everybody knew she was going to run. She's faced no opposition in the primary, and it's kind of go time, is what I would say. We've got less than 45 days to go. We've got early voting underway, and we are facing a money deficit for sure. Democrats are very well funded. The Democrat nominee is Abigail Spanberger, a former CIA agent, member of Congress. She's a strong Democrat, if you're going to give her credit for where she stands among the entire Democrat Party and in terms of the power that she sort of yields as a candidate. But she's just as radical as any of them. You know, we got somebody that is trying to make Virginia a sanctuary state and say that no localities will be cooperating with ICE on immigration issues. She has refused to say whether or not girls should be protected from boys in bathrooms. And, you know, that's a big issue in Northern Virginia. I think there's a lot of other issues as well, like when it comes to the economy and the cost of living. Public safety is big. School choice is still very big in Virginia. And we don't have any state Senate races that are up this cycle. It's only delegate races. But that should be a motivator to make sure that we still have some Republican presence after the good 4 years that we've been experiencing with Glenn Youngkin. But it is notable, in my view, that we've got young voters that hopefully are going to grow in enthusiasm based off of the TPUSA chapters that are being filed in schools all throughout Virginia and New Jersey and all over the country. So I think there's a chance here with the momentum that Republican voters and young voters are feeling that we can still hold this race. It's going to be a dogfight. It's going to be difficult, but that's what we're watching here in Virginia. In New Jersey, Jack Chiarelli is somebody that's run statewide before. He's up against another member of Congress, Mickey Sherrill, and she is, again, just like Abigail Spanberger. They want to say that they're these moderate Democrats that can appeal to independent voters, but when you unpack their record, if they walk like a duck and quack like a duck, they're a duck. And these people are progressive liberals that I don't think they connect and resonate with independents.
Certainly uphill races for Republicans, but, you know, Scott, that's why we run the election.
Yeah, and, you know, in 2021, not a lot of people gave Glenn Youngkin a chance to win against Terry McAuliffe, and Terry McAuliffe put his foot in his mouth saying that parents didn't belong in the classroom, and it became a big parents' rights issue, and we won that race.
Mm-hmm.
So we're calling on Randy Weingartner to come out here and campaign alongside Abigail Spanberger, and we'll see what happens.
Meanwhile, back in the nation's capital, we have a budget deadline of September 30th. And Republicans in the House did their job. They did pass a continuing resolution. Where do we stand now in the Senate? Is this going to get done, or are we headed for a Schumer shutdown?
Well, it seems like we're headed for the Schumer shutdown. This week, the Office of Management and Budget and Director Russ Vogt issued guidance to all federal agencies that not only should they be preparing for federal workers to be furloughed, but they should also prepare to fire them if they are in a program that is lapsing funding and is unnecessary to the continuance of the Trump agenda. I think that that's a pretty wise move. It gives you leverage for the Democrats to come to the table because a lot of these federal workers are going to blame the Democrats since they're the ones that are stonewalling in the Senate and refusing to pass the bill that Republicans responsibly put forward, which would fund government through November 21st. I think that Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, they tried to create leverage and ask for a unique meeting with President Trump. And Trump isn't going to do that. He's not going to take a meeting with those guys when Mike Johnson and John Thune are sitting in the hallway. That would not be a good, fair negotiation. What we normally have is known as a four corners negotiation where the leaders of each chamber, Republican and Democrat in the Senate, Republican, Democrat in the House, come forward and try to hash these agreements out. The Democrats want to have $1 trillion in new federal spending on top of where we're already at. That's just not the way you negotiate a continuing resolution or even an omnibus, especially when you're in the minority. So it seems that they are cooking the books for a Schumer shutdown, And I think that the American people are smart enough to recognize that a shutdown is on the Democrats completely, and people like John Ossoff in Georgia, they're going to have to answer to voters on this when hopefully it's not prolonged too long, but as long as it takes for Republicans to have these Democrats come to the table and say, okay, you've already passed a bill. We don't really have anything that can get Republican votes. Let's move forward and keep the government open and figure out the next opportunity to negotiate. They also want to extend the Obamacare premium tax credits. And these were expanded during Joe Biden's presidency. It costs roughly $400 billion to extend these premium tax credits. And I don't think that Republicans, they're not clamoring to extend a piece of Obamacare and have responsibility on that. The Democrats also want to fund Medicaid for illegal aliens and other federal programs that we defunded through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. This is what you have when you have federal power, unified government for Republicans in Washington. We're winning. We're running up the score. And the Democrats are trying to take the ball and go cry in a corner. But I think that the Schumer shutdown is going to backfire on them. And ultimately, they're going to have to come to the table and meet the Republican bill and pass that one.
We will continue to keep an eye on all of this with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, is with the Club for Growth. And as you usually do, Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. In our nation's capital, we represent over 550,000 members of the Club for Growth from all 50 states. You can visit us at clubforgrowth.org, where you can sign up and become a member for free. And you can also follow us on X at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, once again, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Poland has made tremendous strides in reforming its economy along a free market model. For details, we turn now to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Looking back on his career as one of Poland's most prominent economists and political leaders, Leszek Balcerowicz offered a succinct lesson for policymakers everywhere. In 2012, he told the Wall Street Journal that most problems are the result of bad politics. And I think it follows from there that, of course, if you change the bad politics, then you can fix most of your political problems. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Of course, a dramatic change in politics is exactly what happened in Poland about 35 years ago when the Poles escaped the yoke of Soviet-style central planning. And since then, Poland has undergone a remarkable economic transformation. It's become one of the strongest economies in Europe. Honestly, one of the strongest economies in the entire world. I think that's a story that honestly isn't appreciated enough in the United States. And it's a story that goes back to Leszek Balcerowicz, who was responsible for many of those economic reforms in the 90s. But it's a story that also offers some lessons, I think, not just for other countries in Europe, but honestly, for the United States and for anyone who's interested in helping to build a political culture that allows for that sort of success to happen. So in an upcoming piece in Reason Magazine, I take a look at some of that transformation that Poland has undergone in the past few decades and try to pull some of those lessons out of there. And I think a lot of it actually does start with Balcerowicz, who is somebody that most people, most Americans have probably never heard about or only heard about in passing. He was an economic minister in Poland who was appointed by the new government in 1989 after the Soviet government was tossed out. And at the time, he had no experience in politics or government. He was an economist, but he pioneered what he called a shock therapy approach to liberalizing and privatizing the country's economy. And I think it worked. I go back to that 2012 interview with the Wall Street Journal where he said, as I said before, most problems are the result of bad politics. He went on to say in more detail, and I think this is a really important part of this quote, he says, even if there are angels in the government, which is not the case, if there is not a counterbalance in the form of proponents of limited government, then there will be a shift towards more statism and ultimately into stagnation and crisis. And that wisdom, I think, today is frankly undeniable. So here's a few data points for you. For one, Poland was the only country in Europe that avoided a recession during the 2008-2009 economic crisis. And this year, Poland is expected to surpass Switzerland to become the world's 20th biggest economy in the International Monetary Fund's and the World Bank's ratings, which are based on gross domestic product. So it's just been 35 years since escaping Soviet-style central planning, and Poland no longer has the distinction of just being the most successful economy to come out from behind the Iron Curtain, but it has become a legitimate global powerhouse. And that blunt measure of total GDP might actually undersell just how remarkable this transformation has been. A better metric, I think, might be GDP per capita. And according to the World Bank's data, which is from 2023 and adjusted for inflation, all of these numbers are adjusted for inflation, Poland's GDP per capita was just about $13,000 in 1990 when it was making that transition from communism into capitalism. $13,000, that's it. By 2023, it was $44,000. Now, that still lags behind the European Union average. The average GDP per capita in Europe is about $54,000, but Poland is, you know, right there, and they've closed that gap with stunning speed. In 1990, Poland's GDP per capita was only about 38% of the EU average. By 2000, it was up to right around 50%. By 2010, it was about 60%, and now 82%, and climbing fast. Last year, Poland's economy posted a 3% annual growth rate, while the EU as a whole staggered along at just about 1%. So that gap continues to close. Now, this steady 30-year climb didn't just happen by accident. It was built on a solid foundation of good fiscal policy. Poland is a low-tax country, at least, you know, by European standards. And since the early 2000s, the corporate tax rate has been significantly lower than the global average. The Polish economy also benefits from a relatively small national debt. Hey, there's a lesson there for the United States, right? By law, Poland's national debt cannot exceed 60% of its GDP. And just to put that into context here, the United States has $29 trillion in debt held by the public and $37 trillion in national debt total. But if we had a similar cap on how much we could borrow, the national debt would be only about $17 trillion right now. It would be much more manageable over the long term. So Poland's economic success, I think, is even more striking when you contrast it with other Central European countries. Hungary, for example, was actually significantly wealthier than Poland back in 1990 when the average Pole was earning only $13,000 per year. The average Hungarian was earning $21,000 per year. But Poland has now moved significantly ahead of Hungary in that per capita GDP ranking. And while Poland's economy was posting 3% growth last year, Hungary's economy sank into recession. Now, I pick out Hungary specifically because Hungarian President Viktor Orban, who embarked on this economic and ideological project to remake the country in the 2010s, you know, has gotten a lot of attention lately from especially conservatives, especially here in the United States, but also around the rest of the world. He's had a sort of rhetorical approach to politics that has appealed to conservatives and nationalists everywhere. But the result of that shift towards statism in Hungary has been, as Balcerowicz warned us, a shift towards stagnation. And so you've seen Poland grow, and I think grow in a way that hasn't gotten as much attention as maybe Hungary has, even though the policies in Poland have been the ones that have proven to be more successful over the long term. So Hungary's brash strongman might be skilled at drawing attention to himself, but it's Poland's low-key stability and perpetual growth that really shows the way forward, and not just for Europe, but for any place that throws off the shackles of an authoritarian ideology and the central planning that comes with it. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out my latest piece, How Did Poland Get So Far Ahead of Hungary? You can find that right now at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The assassination of Charlie Kirk has galvanized generations of young Americans, which will be his lasting legacy. Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, offers his remembrance on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I was so sickened and saddened by the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Many of us can't quite explain why it affected us so deeply. Pundits have used words like watershed event or a turning point for the country. I personally didn't know Kirk, but still, wow, what happened was so brutal, so upsetting, so tragic. It's hard to stop thinking about it. Ironically, about a half hour before Kirk was shot, three of my students approached me about bringing him to Grove City College, which is a college where I teach in Grove City, Pennsylvania. I dismissed the idea by telling them what I always told students with that request. I said, look, Charlie Kirk isn't interested in a conservative campus like Grove City College. He wants to go to campuses where students disagree with him so Charlie can engage them. Indeed, Kirk would start every dialogue session at his campus rallies with this exhortation. He would say, okay, those who disagree with me, come to the head of the line. You go first. The dialogue then commenced. Charlie Kirk died doing exactly that. Older folks surprised by the outpouring of support for Charlie Kirk should know that he was enormously influential among American youth, many of which watched his posts and videos daily. He was so influential that some believe that the 31-year-old could become president of the United States one day. In fact, the current president of the United States told Kirk just that. Said Donald Trump, quote, I actually said, Charlie, someday I think you have a good chance at being president. You have a shot. I think he would have had a great chance. He was a very compelling person. Another influential young podcaster and Kirk contemporary went further. The day after Kirk's death, Michael Knowles dramatically posted a single across a black screen statement on his Facebook page. It read simply, quote, Charlie Kirk would have been president, unquote. It wasn't merely that Charlie Kirk was influential among young conservative Republicans. The reality is that he had wide appeal beyond the choir. Moderates and liberals watched him too. Present at that Utah rally were two prominent liberal podcasters who were known for spending time with Kirk and jostling with him. They enjoyed that. All were sick of cancel culture. They all craved the free exchange of ideas. A word to liberals who are listening right now and might not like what I've said so far. Look, I understand that you didn't like Kirk's ideas, nor maybe perhaps the man himself. You may have found some of his beliefs repugnant. Fine. And sure, you can point to examples where he didn't comport himself in ways that you found acceptable. However, I can tell you that after years of carefully observing Kirk, that he got much better at what he did as time went on. He matured and became much more polished. He was mastering the skill, the art of civil dialogue. Few were doing it so well. Obviously, he was never perfect. None of us are. He had good moments and he had bad moments. But surely, if you're a genuine liberal who has long preached freedom of speech and diversity of thought, you must concede that it was refreshing to see a young conservative like Kirk devote his life to going into hostile ground to engage his detractors. Gosh, man, put aside your political, ideological emotions and anger and concede the obvious. Now, was Charlie Kirk trying to change minds to his side? Well, of course. But so were his interlocutors, in a civil way. How rare and how refreshing. And that brings me back to the president point. How wonderful it would have been if we had a president of the United States who spent a career mastering the craft of friendly discourse. Imagine a president who didn't insult his opponents as morons and scumbags, or from the other side, someone who didn't call their opponents fascists and Nazis, as they did to Charlie Kirk. Imagine a leader who views opponents as children of God, made in the image of God, with a dignity that demands respect. Charlie Kirk actually said that all the time. But alas, with Charlie Kirk, it looks like that's never going to happen. It's possible that one day we might have had such a president, but no. May Charlie Kirk rest in peace, and may his wife and two children somehow find peace. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMGM-FM and WTKU-FM in Linwood, New Jersey, along with WHAI-FM in Greenfield, Massachusetts. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.